Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News, the first episode of the post-Palin era.
I believe I not being a candidate, really, you're unshackled and you're allowed to be even more active.
I'm Ron Elving.
I'm Ken Rudin. I'm not convinced Sarah Palin's not running.
I am convinced she's not running because I have been convinced she was not running all year.
We all said that and we were not surprised. And yet she loved to keep the attention on her and say, well, it's not too late for other candidates to get in. And I think I'll take my bus tour to the obvious vacation spots of Iowa and New Hampshire.
And Washington, D.C., Rolling Thunder.
And so, look, not a surprise, but I think she was her hand was forced because of two things, Chris Christie and George Pataki.
George Pataki is breathing down her neck. Right. No question. We'll get back to the Pataki juggernaut in just a moment. But
one reason we
knew that Sarah Palin was not running in 2012 was that Sarah Palin never did anything to run in 2011.
Well, you have to do something.
Right.
Yes.
Even Chris Christie.
I can't wait to jump in on here. Everybody said that if anybody could do it, it's Sarah Palin. Everybody said that to run. No, I agree with you. And the listeners should see Ron's face, and I agree with Ron's face. Matter of fact, I love Ron's face.
The listener should see your face, Carol.
Well, but everybody said that, you know, she doesn't have to have a national staff. She doesn't have to be raising money. And I'll say, how is this possible? Nobody's ever done it before in the history of modern presidential politics.
And it would not be a legitimate campaign. It would not be the kind of campaign that could actually win, but it could be the kind of campaign that would get a certain amount of attention. And in fact, we do see other candidates right now with very similar kinds of situations who are getting a lot of attention and are doing well in the polls. Herman Cain. He doesn't really have a campaign. He doesn't really have a presence around the country. He's not even really particularly well organized in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Do you know what he's doing for the next month? He's on a book tour. He's not taking advantage of the Florida straw poll or the new national polls where he's tied in the CBS poll. He's tied for first with Mitt Romney.
He's tied for first.
He's tied for
first. And he's showing about the same number as the CBS poll in several other national polls.
Yeah.
It may not be the number one position. He may not be on top. But he's showing about 17% of the total national Republican vote.
Yes, but at the same...
And in this field, that's enough to be taken seriously.
Yes, in October of 2011. And the early part of October 2011. The reason I say that is because we were all gaga over Lady Michelle Bachmann.
That was a couple of months ago.
In the August straw poll in Iowa. She was the front runner, or at least a rising star that lasted
all... She won the Ames straw poll. That's always something.
And that lasted until Rick Perry got in the race. And Rick Perry was the front runner.
Oh, totally. In fact, people were asking me, you know, do you think Perry will be a two-term president? Seriously. People were asking me that. People were saying, who will Rick Perry choose as his running mate? Can Barack Obama beat Rick Perry? These were serious questions in August and September.
Right, exactly. And so we had these bursts of front runner ism,
brief front runner status
for all these candidates. So, of course, now, you know, we would have had Chris Christie.
For me, the answer was never anything but no.
Now, again, I was not surprised at this either. The fact that conservatives were just pining for Chris Christie to get in the race, and yet on issues like global warming and gun control, issues like that.
He was for civil unions.
He was for civil unions,
I mean,
it was
not an orthodox set of positions.
No, he was more reform conservative.
I understand.
Exactly. But the thing is, and yet even the conservatives were questioning Rick Perry's orthodoxy with the stuff on the children of illegal immigrants getting in-state tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And the HPV vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So
clearly, they were not vetting these candidates for perfection. They were trying to find somebody they saw as being a dominant figure whom they could see on stage with Barack Obama.
Or are they just not happy with Mitt Romney? And this search for somebody else may be, again, part of the anybody but Romney crusade.
It is odd that they are willing to admit all these other apostasies for other candidates whom they like better, Chris Christie, as you say, Rick Perry.
Donald Trump for a while.
Yeah, but not for Mitt Romney.
Right.
They are not willing to accept his imperfections.
And in fact, they are serious
imperfections from the standpoint of a doctrinaire conservative. I think Obamacare may be the biggest one. That is to say, the program that they had in Massachusetts that the White House used is something of a model for Obama's health care plan. But there are many, and I think it's not about Mormonism. I really don't think.
I agree.
This time around. Last time around, I think that was a factor. This time, I think it's less that than a almost personality rejection. They don't like him.
But watching him in the debates, I feel that he's more comfortable than
getting
ever.
Getting better and better.
Polished than ever. And again, if you look at the one-on-one against President Obama, certainly Mitt Romney does better in the polls than any other Republican.
He's the only one who wins or pulls even.
And the question we've always said on this podcast is the issue of beating Obama or having a true believer of the faith. And that's what we saw with Barry Goldwater in 64. Was Barry Goldwater going to defeat Lyndon Johnson? Perhaps not, but they were not going to have the Eastern establishment dictating who the nominee would be.
That's right, and that all made sense for the 2012 dynamic until recently. Until recently, I think a lot of Republicans felt that this was a similar year to 64 in the sense that Obama was probably on his way to re-election, and this was a time to establish their dominance within the party.
Right.
So they wanted their own guy. Now, however, as the president looks increasingly vulnerable, they think, wait a minute, we could win this thing. And now you hear Michelle Bachmann and others saying, let's not settle. That's the word she used. Let's not settle just for electability. Let's get somebody who will be a true champion of our cause, because we're going to win. We're going to win because Obama's going to lose. And because he's going to lose, we can choose anybody we want.
Well, actually, I heard that with the Pennsylvania reapportioning of electoral votes. There were some Republicans, obviously, in the state who want to change the winner-take-all with the Pennsylvania electoral votes and do it proportionally. And some Republicans saying, wait a second, we could beat Obama in Pennsylvania.
We're going to take Pennsylvania.
Why would you change it exactly?
Well, they've got the governorship. They've got the legislature.
Right.
They're showing every sign of being on the march, even now in Pennsylvania, a year after those sweeping elections of 2010. So it does seem an odd time to change the rules, just as you might be able to take home all the marbles.
I don't think Palin getting out of the race does much. Does Christie getting out of the race affect, does it help hurt somebody?
I think it does in this sense, that it's got to make a lot of Republicans start to think, okay, we've got to stop messing around. We've got to get behind somebody. And
this is the hand we've been dealt.
That's right. And so let's get behind Mitt. And that's the one reason that I think Perry's tough 2 weeks in September when he had those bad debates. Well, three, really, but they got worse each one after the other. And in fact, even within the debates, he was worse toward the end than in the beginning. So that was untimely for him, not so much because we're so close to the first voting. We're not. But
although we're getting closer, and we'll talk about that soon.
Clearly we are. And it didn't hurt his fundraising. He had the best fundraising of any of the Republican candidates by far in the third quarter.
$17 million.
Which is a lot considering he wasn't even in but a certain number of days. What, 49 days of the quarter? So he was raising a lot of money every day. And I think he is clearly the front runner from the standpoint of fundraising. Still, it was a bad time for him to look unprepared, not just because we're getting closer to the actual event, but because this was the moment at which the pulling out of Palin and Christie exposed the field as final and made people decide they needed to start picking a winner now. A lot of those folks in the New York metropolitan area, powerful figures, fundraisers and so on, who were trying desperately to get Christie to run, have now gone over to Mitt Romney's camp with the message of, come on, everybody, it's time to get realistic.
Well, at the same time, having mentioned, as you mentioned, the $17 million that Rick Perry raised, I think now that the field is complete, I think everybody feels this is it. The teasing of Christie is gone. The Palin teasing is over. October 11th, the next debate at Dartmouth, New Hampshire. Look, Rick Perry has had three opportunities to make his case. He's failed each time by worse and worse amounts. But again, I think he does get a second look. I think people realize now this is the field, and I think this may be the most important debate, well, certainly so far.
Yes, in a sense, each one is more important than the last ones. But for him, if he does not have at least a decent performance, if he doesn't at least make people think, well, that's the best he's done, then I think there are going to be really, really serious consequences for his fundraising. And if he's not ahead in fundraising, not ahead in the polls, and not impressing people in the debates, you really have to wonder why he's in the race.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I suggest and one of the reasons that Chris Christie decided not to run is the creeping calendar. And we've seen some dramatic things in the last week. We saw, of course, Florida move up to January 31st. And that meant South Carolina is moving up to January 21st. And that means Nevada will move up to January 14th.
That sets up a squeeze for New Hampshire because they go on a Tuesday night. Well, it would mean they would have to go on the 3rd. Now, the 10th is too close to Nevada. They want to have more separation.
State law says it has to be 7 days within 7 days of the
any
next
other kind of event.
Well, no, last time in 2008, Iowa was January 3rd and New Hampshire was January 8th. It was only 5 days in 2008. But afterwards, they have to have at least a week separation from the subsequent contests.
All right. So if they go into the first week of January to hold the New Hampshire primary, when does Iowa have its caucus? You can't get the Iowa caucus that close to the New Hampshire primary. And they have traditionally done it on Monday nights. And that
although last time was a Thursday, believe it or not.
Traditionally, and they didn't like it. But they're just going to get too close to New Hampshire in any direction they go, unless they leap all the way into December.
Everybody was making the jokes last time of spending New Year's Eve in Iowa.
Which we did.
But the thought of spending Christmas and New Year's Eve is another unwelcome thought.
I think that's a non-starter, and that's why I think the people in Iowa, if they do go into December, go into early December, not just the week or two before January, but all the way into the first week, perhaps, or second week of December. They could go as early as December 5th. That's a Monday night. Now, that's a horror, and it's very close to Thanksgiving, and of course, it's in the midst of the Christmas season. Nobody wants to have any of these events before Christmas, and yet the crowding that's caused largely here by Florida, really, and then the response of the four early events to the Florida move is going to crowd somebody right out of January at the rate we're going, unless Iowa and New Hampshire can negotiate something between them.
I still think there will be a negotiation. I still predict Iowa January 2nd, New Hampshire January 10th. Obviously, these states mean different things for the candidates. The thought is that South Carolina and Florida moving up is good news for Rick Perry, the only true native of the South. I mean, Newt Gingrich nominally from Georgia, but he's not considered.
Well, and Herman Cain from Georgia.
And Herman Cain, true, from Georgia as well. But Nevada, big Romney state, moving up to the middle of January as well. And if Romney's going to do well in New Hampshire, as many people think, that could be a boost for him too. So a lot. It's be interesting to know how much of the Romney and Perry forces are behind these movings in the states.
Well, I believe the Romney campaign came out and said today that they had lobbied with the Nevadans to move them as early as possible, because they are trying to get a 1-2 punch out of New Hampshire and Nevada and counter, as you were saying. The assumption that Iowa is going to be tough for Romney this time, and that South Carolina and Florida would be in Perry's camp.
Quick news of the week, Ron Elving, quick news of the week. Earl Ray Tomlin, the Democrat, the acting Democratic governor of West Virginia, won a narrow margin over Bill Maloney, the Republican businessman, 50-47. The Republicans desperately tried to tie Tomlin in with Obama, but it failed.
Spent a lot of money, too.
Spent a lot of money. But again, this is a 2-1 Democratic state and was 50-47. I think both sides got something to take away from that election.
All right. Other news in statewide races. We had in Massachusetts a debate among the Democratic candidates for the Senate nomination against Scott Brown. And a lot of people thought Elizabeth Warren, who's the best known of those candidates outside the state, did pretty well.
I think national Democrats clearly would love Elizabeth Warren to run against Scott Brown. Polls showed very, very close, a general election, but she still has to get past the September primary. I think in her first test in the debate, she certainly succeeded.
Longtime member of Congress from Illinois, Jerry Costello, from southern Illinois, southwestern corner down there near St. Louis and some of the suburbs of St. Louis, has declared his intention not to run for re-election. That could be a tough seat for the Democrats.
That is surprising because, you know, basically Costello helped draw the Illinois congressional map, and a lot of Republicans were put in very precarious positions, and we thought the Democrats would never have to worry about that seat, Costello's seat, because he's won comfortably in the past. With him not running, that could open up for both parties.
And who held this seat before Jerry Costello?
I was thinking of that today.
Very powerful chairman of a House committee, one of the most powerful chairman of any House committee.
Mel Price. Wow.
Armed Services Committee. Very good, Ken Merton. A couple of passings to take note of this week. Fred Shuttlesworth, the legendary minister at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, where that bombing took the lives of those little girls. Fred Shuttlesworth, one of the great leaders of the civil rights movement in the 50s, the 1960s, contemporary of Martin Luther King.
He, along with Dr. King, was among the founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They were untold innumerable attempts on his life.
Bombed his house.
Bombed his church, threats on his life. One of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement died this week.
And one of the unsung heroes of Watergate also died this week, Ken Dahlberg of Minnesota.
Ken Dahlberg was the Midwest financial coordinator for the committee to reelect the president, Richard Nixon's campaign apparatus, in 1972. And he was the guy, if you remember reading All the President's Men, he was the guy that...
I read the movie.
You read the movie? Well, he was the guy who...
He was the guy whose money they were following.
Yes. He was the guy who gave checks to money that wound up in the bank accounts of the Watergate burglars. And when Bob Woodward asked Dahlberg, did you write the check? He said, yes. I mean, he was basically the honest guy who said it was Ken Dahlberg's account that basically led the connection between the committee to reelect the president and the Watergate burglars.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rubin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Nixon now, Nixon now, he's made the